This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. Researchers concluded long ago that segregated schools and neighborhoods are linked to racial inequality. In other words, separate and equal is impossible. But as a PhD student at Duke University, Sarah Mayorga-Gallo wanted to find out if the converse is true, if there is a link between diverse neighborhoods and more racial equality. She studied a community in Durham that she calls Creek Ridge Park. And while it was racially and socioeconomically diverse, her findings indicate that simply living there is not enough to prevent inequality. Her research is compiled in a book called Behind the White Picket Fence, Power and Privilege in a Multi-Ethnic Neighborhood. Sarah Mayorga-Gallo is now a sociology professor at the University of Cincinnati, and she joins me now on the State of Things. Sarah, welcome. Good to talk with you.
Great. Thank you so much for having me, Frank.
Tell us what led to this inquiry of yours. What were you thinking about that led you to do the study?
Sure. Well, as a PhD student, I was really interested in sort of the intersection of racial and ethnic inequality and demography or, you know, population studies. And so one of the fields that really bridges those two areas is residential segregation research. So I really wanted to study a statistically integrated neighborhood as sort of a natural experiment of the claims, like you mentioned, made by many social scientists of what happens in those spaces. And so looking around at the census data, I stumbled upon Creek Ridge Park and decided that I really wanted to understand what the day-to-day social life was like for the residents that live there across racial and class lines. So I interviewed Black, white, and Latino residents to really understand what Creek Ridge Park and an integrated multi-ethnic neighborhood is like.
So what is an integrated multi-ethnic neighborhood? How do you even define such a thing?
Well, there are two main thoughts in sort of the demographic sociological literature. One, and the most popular, is the proportional representation at the city and the neighborhood level. So based on what the demographics are citywide in Durham, then if that's also what is present at the neighborhood level, then that would be considered statistically integrated. So that's really about proportions. And the second main definition is about a Black population that's between 10 and 50% of the neighborhood.
Will you describe then the neighborhood you studied in Durham?
Absolutely. I think both of those definitions fit. And what I was really interested in is, you know, if we're going and understanding that we think residential integration is really about equity across races and across class, then perhaps something more deep than proportionality is what we should be using as a measure. And we should really look at things like power sharing and interactions. And so that's what I was really trying to capture in the book.
So the neighborhood looked that way. I mean, again, when you think about anything as broad as a neighborhood, if you take a 6-square block or 8-square block area, and you think, well, if I count the number of people in there and then divide by the number of ethnicities, it comes out a certain way. But if people are still clustered, you know, one block after another, I mean, is that really integration or does that matter in your definition?
Absolutely. I think it definitely matters. And so one of the maps I include in the book is sort of these subregions. And so looking at, okay, across the neighborhood, we, you know, based on these statistical definitions, Creek Ridge Park is integrated. But then you also then in the northeast corner have Pine Grove Apartments, which is predominantly Black and Latino. And that's where a large portion of the Black and Latino population live. And then in the southern area of the neighborhood, you have a larger concentration of white homeowners. So then, you know, these then complicate the picture of what we mean when we say a multi-ethnic or an integrated neighborhood, for sure.
So let's talk a little bit about then how you went about this. You did find concentrations of African-American and Latino populations within this so-called integrated neighborhood. Then how do you go about getting the information you need?
Sure. So my strategy was threefold. So first was sort of this participant observation component. And I went to neighborhood association events. I spent time in the neighborhood. I went to businesses in the area, just kind of sitting, hanging around and watching residents in those spaces. And then I also did in-depth interviews and I spoke with those were snowball sampled. So I spoke with residents who were both involved in the association and weren't, people who had lived there, you know, for decades and, you know, more recent transplants. And then the third component was a household survey. And so that was trying to get a sense of more of these attitudinal measures, which to really try to, you know, as much as I'm not arguing about generalizability in this study, I am trying to capture some of these social processes. So it's, I think the attitude data is helpful to compare across some more national measures.
Well, the book opens with a scene from a community picnic. Maybe you can describe what you saw at that event.
Sure. So I had been in the field for, I think, about a year at that point. And I go to this picnic, and it's the picnics have been described by several of the respondents that I spoke to, particularly white homeowners, as really well attended. And so I was looking forward to this picnic to kind of to finally see it in action. And so when I arrived, there are about, I would say, 20 people there. Most of them I've already met either through the neighborhood association or some other contact. And while I'm there talking to the mostly white homeowners, Roberta comes. And Roberta is a petite black woman who no one seems to know her. And she's carrying what I remember as is I guess like a Kroger bag with it seems to have some sort of a cake in it or something to share, which is what the advertisements asked for. And basically the area, everyone stares at Roberta, but no one really interacts with her. So Roberta goes over, signs in, and she, ends up buying T-shirt from the neighborhood association, even though the $12 cost is something that she thought was pretty steep. And actually, one of the interactions I noticed was that Tammy, who's someone that I had met and I thought was very, had been very kind to me, coldly tells Roberta that she should not sign in and fill out the raffle form on top of the book that they're trying to raffle off. And so Roberta then proceeds to the table with the snacks and gifts, and drinks, and cuts herself a piece of cake and then takes a seat. And so I kind of watch her. She's sitting by herself for most of the party, and there are only a couple of people that go over and speak with her. And eventually I go over and I ask her, you know, what her name is, where she's from, and she says that she lives in one of the townhouses on the other side of the neighborhood. And she says that, you know, she really wanted to kind of go outside of her comfort zone and decided to come today because she had gotten a flyer for the party. What I noted was, she kind of basically was left alone for most of the party. And I do talk about in the book as well as how I'd hoped to connect with her afterwards, but was unsuccessful in doing so.
And how did she feel about the experience? In other words, you've got, I think there's the subject of experience is important. How do people who live in those neighborhoods, how do they think of themselves and whether or not they're, you know, living kind of an integrated life and are open-minded and feeling welcome, and then sort of objective measures. So from the subjective point of view, you noticed that Roberta was isolated. How did she feel?
Well, I never got a chance to talk to her. She was in really good spirits that day. And when I asked her if she would be willing to let me interview her, she was very open, gave me her phone number. She had even shared where she worked. And I tried to follow up with her and nothing really came of that. And so I actually used Roberta's example as well to reflect on my own field position. So I'm Latina, but I'm read as white in most of these sort of non-traditional Latino hubs, Durham being one of them. And so, I had access to a lot of the white homeowners, but I think that also, you know, in this interaction, I probably was read as one of those with privilege just in this space as well. So I think it's as much as I'm trying to critique this system, I'm also I hope not to lay blame in terms of, you know, good or evil, which I think when we talk about inequality and racial inequality in particular, that tends to be the focus. But I'm really hoping that we can shift it from individual level blame to more about power differences and how, you know, as a white-looking graduate student from an elite institution, I held a lot of power in the space where, as you know, one of the only black women in this neighborhood and in this event, Roberta certainly was marginalized.
Well, let's talk about power then, a sort of more objective measure of who has privilege and who doesn't in these integrated neighborhoods. You talk about white codes being part of the power structure. Explain those.
Right. So white codes are basically, it's a term I use to capture the interracial norms and how basically the normative behaviors that are sanctioned both positively and negatively in this neighborhood by white homeowners. And I focus particularly on the white homeowners because they're the ones that wield a lot of power in both as represented through the neighborhood association, but in also having the police respond to them in positive ways, you know, having the police come and meet with them where, you know, in the chapter where I talk about the experiences of the Black and Latino residents, that's not the experience that they share. So white codes is really meant to capture some of these patterns and behaviors that reproduce inequality.
And in particular, they play out in if you have a neighborhood association and there are particular sanctions about keeping up your property, you found that they're applied differently across racial lines.
Right. Well, and one of the things that I noticed and that I asked in the housing survey was for people to identify their friendship groups. And so the friendship data was really important because it showed that although you had this sort of the lauding of diversity by the white homeowners in particular, their social networks were incredibly white. So it's like, you know, how do you have this juxtaposition of saying diversity is great, but then also having sort of these monoracial friendship networks? And so one of the outcomes of this is that, you know, let's say you were to have when you deal with a neighborhood conflict, for example, I had several residents say, you know, if it's someone I know and if it's a friend I trust, then, you know, I'm going to discuss it or I'll just ignore it. You know, if it's an older woman next door and it's her dog's barking, well, I'm not going to give her a hard time about it because I know her. But then if it's a stranger, then I found that residents were much more likely to call the police, you know, report violations to the neighborhood improvement services. Or there was even one instance where a neighbor tried to have one of the Mary, who I talk about in the book, who's a longtime black renter, who tried to get her evicted because her son's littering on her neighbor's property. So again, I think the white coats capture how things that we might think as non-racial, right, this divide of friends and stranger actually ends up producing racialized outcomes because it's taking place within, you know, sort of this, what I also call this white urban middle class habitus, or this, you know, this within the particular racial climate of this multi-ethnic neighborhood.
It's the fact that you haven't really opened up your network, and it's networking that allows us to be more open-minded about our relationships and whether or not we call the police or handle it ourselves. That's where the breakdown is. So when you talked, and again, getting back to the subjective measures, talk to white homeowners and residents about this diversity, how do they talk about it, their neighborhood, and themselves in it? I mean, is there a lot of self-congratulations for living in a place where you can look around and see all this diversity?
Yeah, I think there was definitely an interesting sort of distancing from other types of white homeowners. So in particular, those who live in suburban spaces. So living close to downtown, living in a place where lots of different types of people, there was definitely a framing of, you know, we are a certain type of white person that's different than those other white people, which I thought was really interesting. So they saw the suburbs as really, you know, narrow-minded, sterile, you know, conservative, all of these, and couching those terms as really negative. And so what was interesting, too, is what was considered diversity. So often race was used and certainly class and even sexuality. But then so were things like lawn care. It became a much broader, it included a much broader realm of ideas that, then removed the focus from inequality. So it became kind of this abstract, acceptance of difference rather than, something that was related to challenging, inequity.
Well, what do you mean? Give me an example of what you mean by an expression about lawn care and how that suggested, I guess, their ideas about themselves and how they differed from other white homeowners, you're saying?
Well, there's one example where there was a resident who was saying that he did not want to be like those people. And he might have used South Point or Cary as a reference point. Those were two popular references to say that we are different. Creek Ridge Park is different than those two sort of Durham area locales. And he saw, you know, the regulations around whether, you know, you call neighborhood improvement services or not as examples of things that, you know, we're not those kinds of people, right? That's outside of the norms that we want to accept here. So I think that that it was an interesting framing, again, of that diversity, but then it not necessarily being tied to any sort of different behavior in their interactions with residents of color.
And you also talked to minority residents. How do they feel about living in these neighborhoods?
Yeah, well, the way that I captured it in that final chapter is really I saw it as both the material benefits and social costs. So Cheryl is a great example. She's one of the Black homeowners I spoke with, and you know, she was very frank about, you know, I wanted to live in a multi-ethnic integrated neighborhood, not because I think there's anything wrong with predominantly Black neighborhoods, but I know that in this racialized system, if I live in a predominantly Black neighborhood, my home will be devalued. So I want my home and my investment in my home to be something that, you know, gives me the economic benefits that it should. And so she was really mindful of that. And at the same time, she sort of couched that economic decision against the fact that she was incredibly socially isolated. And she said that, you know, her neighbors didn't really talk to her till the fifth or sixth year that she was there. And she connects that to the fact that she started planting flowers in her front yard. And then that in some ways made her more approachable, or that's how she saw it. That the white residents saw that, you know, that, oh, she's invested, she's a homeowner. She's not like those other types of Black people. So I think that that's, you know, it's certainly a more complicated experience than the one that was generally more positive than white homeowners expressed.
Have you shared your findings with any of the white residents of your neighborhood?
I have. I've contacted everyone that participated in an interview, and I let them know about the book publication. And so a few of them have responded and said that they're looking forward to reading it. And before I left Durham, I also had sent to those participants sort of the summary of my survey data. So I have shared some of it, although I haven't heard from anyone recently.
Oh, I was going to ask you what they thought of it.
Yeah. A lot of it was just excitement about the project and seeing the product, but no one's contacted me specifically after reading the book. Looking forward to that.
What do you make of all this? I mean, this is there's an inherent. It would be fair to call it a kind of hypocrisy. This kind of sense of self-righteousness, maybe self-congratulations is a softer term, about sort of living among and yet not living with and not sharing the life of, which is part of your finding here. You're very keen not to call this blame and not to make this a kind of finger pointing. What are the lessons then that we can take away from this?
Yeah, so I think it's really just about being cognizant of sort of this, what I call diversity ideology, right? This idea that we're celebrating difference without really talking about power, without really talking about inequality, without talking about the ways that we're all part of a system that reproduces these relations. And so I'm really hoping that in particular, rather than, you know, kind of drinking the Kool-Aid and thinking, you know, we've made it with these multi-ethnic spaces, to really think, you know, are these really equitable? And are these really places that, you know, white, Black, Latino, and all different communities feel included and represented?
All right, Sarah, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Sarah Mayorga-Gallo is a sociology professor at the University of Cincinnati. Her book is A Profile of a Neighborhood in Durham. It's called Behind the White Picket Fence, Power and Privilege in a Multi-Ethnic Neighborhood. The State of Things continues in a moment. Stay tuned.